It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about one Wisconsin man's quest to increase police accountability after the death of his son, and what lessons can be applied to what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri.
First, our next guest is in support of a ballot initiative that would split the state of California into six smaller states. He says doing the same thing with big populous states like Texas, Florida, New York would make for more efficient, accountable government.
Turns out splitting up states is a possibility provided for in the Constitution, although it hasn't been done since the Civil War era.
Michael Lynn joins us now. He's a columnist at Salon and a policy director at the New America Foundation. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with California, which has an actual ballot initiative to split the state into six smaller states. Why do you think this is a good idea for citizens and for government?
Well, if you look at our 50-state system today, there's enormous disproportion between the populations of the largest and the smallest states. By 2025, there could be a 70-to-1 difference between the population of California and of Wyoming. And what that means is that members of the citizens of states with small populations have vastly greater power in the Senate and indirectly in the Electoral College than do citizens of large states like California, Texas, and New York. In fact, it's been calculated that, in theory, 17% of American voters could elect half of the members of the U.S. Senate because of the malapportionment of the United States Senate with two senators for every state.
And you believe that by doing something along these lines would increase accountability and efficiency in the U.S. government. How would that happen?
Well, it would increase accountability because it's much easier for ordinary citizens to have an impact on their state governments if it's a small state, a small population state. I'm not talking about geographic territory, about population. It's easier to meet your governor if you live in Vermont than if you live in Texas or California or New York. So scale makes a difference. If you have a smaller unit, then the price of statewide political marketing campaigns is much lower. And as I point out in my Salon piece, in the early 20th century, John Nance Garner, the Texas politician who was Franklin Roosevelt's first vice president, argued for breaking up Texas precisely for the reason of the cost of statewide Texas political campaigns.
Now, there are people, including Tea Party affiliates, who see the federal government as bloated and riddled with redundancies, and they'd like to see more power coming from the state government. So if you split the states, don't you weaken everything but the federal government?
Well, you have to remember we have three levels of government. There's the local, that is cities and counties, and then above that there's the states, and above that there's the federal government. And as I argued in my Salon piece, why would any rational person prefer a state government, particularly in a very large populous state, to the city government? If you look at K-12 systems, for example, now they're funded about half by the state and about halfway by the local community. But there's a rebellion against Common Core standards being imposed by the federal government and to some extent by state governments. People like local control. A lot of infrastructure is local. A lot of utilities are within the metro area or the county. So the real question is, what exactly do state capitals do that are not done better either by cities and counties or by the federal government? So if you had, and remember, most Americans now live within a fairly limited number of major metro areas. So it's just a question of why you aggregate some metro areas inside of the borders of a very populous state as opposed to letting these major metro areas have more influence within a smaller state.
But if you're, sort of busting down the state government and putting the priority on your local government, a smaller unit of government, doesn't the very fact that it's smaller give it less power?
Well, not necessarily. The main issue with small governments is resources. And so I argue that if you're going to have more states and smaller states, it would be best to accompany that with some kind of revenue sharing. But that's best done at the federal level anyway, not within the state level. So it is the case that, let's say, within a state like California, The small towns may benefit from taxing Los Angeles and San Francisco and redistributing some of the revenue. But if you want to have a revenue sharing system, it would be much better to do it on a continental basis, not just within state borders.
I'm a little hung up on the practicality of this proposal in that if say we split California into five smaller states, doesn't that create five more states within the United States? Five more stars on the flag, five more state capitals. Are we really getting rid of state government, or are we just increasing, multiplying the amount of state government?
Well, arguably, you would have state government that's closer to the people and less likely to be captured by big interest groups, or whether they're labor unions on the left or corporate interests on the right. You know, one of the problems is with particularly with large states. I'm a Texan myself, and I worked in the Texas state government. You know, within a very large populous state, the state government itself is kind of like a miniature federal government. It's very remote from ordinary citizens. It's very difficult for them to monitor it compared to their local city politics. So, you know, I think experience shows that smaller states are more transparent and more accountable than these enormous states which have populations as big as many countries in the world, like Texas and California and Florida and New York.
What does the Constitution have to say about this?
Well, it actually allows state borders to be redrawn. Article 4, Section 3, Clause 1, if you want to look it up, says new states may be admitted by the Congress into this union, but no new state shall be formed or erected within the jurisdiction of any other state, nor any state formed by junction of two or more states or parts of states, without the consent of the legislatures of the states concerned as well as of Congress. So there are two very difficult bars you have to pass. One is, if you're going to subdivide a state, the state legislature or the state government has to approve. The other is that Congress has to approve as well. And in that case, you have the jealousy of existing states don't want their power in the Senate diluted by having more senators come to the Senate. So, you know, it's more of a thought experiment than a practical proposal. But nevertheless, the case is, if you look in the long run, if you get to the point where California has, let's say, 80 million people, and, you know, some of these small western states like Wyoming have 500,000 people, and each is represented by two senators, you do have to wonder what will happen. And if the majority of the American population, which lives now in a fairly small number of populous states, think that essentially rural, underpopulated states are thwarting what they want to get through Congress, and arguably that's already a pattern, then there's going to be more pressure for presidents to simply circumvent Congress and to govern by decree. And to some extent, you could argue we see this already with both the support and the opposition to President Obama's plan to try to do things by executive order because of stagnation in the Congress. So I think there is a real serious threat to democracy that if we don't have a more equally apportioned Senate, then we're going to move towards a kind of Latin American plebiscitary presidential system where you have small population states are just blocking things that the overwhelming majority of Americans want, and that to get around this, the president, who is elected by this large popular majority, will simply circumvent Congress and claim executive authority to do things that can't be done by legislation.
If it's easier to get a meeting with a governor in a smaller state, isn't it then therefore easier for a lobbyist to do it as well?
No, remember, the lobbyists get their access mainly because of the high price of political advertising campaigns. And the larger the market, the larger the political market of a state, the more expensive it is to run for statewide office. So you will always have lobbying in one form or another. But that particular incentive of corruption, the need to raise millions of dollars to compete in a geographically enormous political advertising market, you can reduce somewhat.
We're talking about a proposal to split up big populous states to make smaller statelets. Michael Lind is the policy director at the New America Foundation. He wrote about this idea in Salon.
And we want to know what you think. Does it make sense to split up big, high population states? Would it make it easier for people to influence politics and government? You can let us know your thoughts at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about an idea to split up big population-rich states and make smaller statelets. Our guest says it's a thought experiment, but if it happened, it could make government more accountable, more democratic, and more efficient. Michael Lind is the policy director at the New America Foundation. He wrote about this idea in Salon.
And we want to know what you think. What about Wisconsin? Does it deserve its two senators? Is Wisconsin big enough to keep them? And do you think that larger states should be split apart in this way? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Let's take a call from Rob in Appleton. Hi, Rob.
Hello. I'd just like to know what your speaker thinks about the fact that it's kind of just another form of gerrymandering in which we'll break up the states and take the power away from the smaller states. The compromise that happened when the Founding Fathers was done for a reason, to split the populous states and then give everybody an equal voice to start with. And I'll take my comments up here.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, I'm glad your caller raised the Founding Fathers. Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, Madison was known as the father of the Constitution, they actually opposed this compromise that gave the small states an equal number of senators with the large states. So the disproportion in population was not as great then as it is now. But if you read the Federalist Papers, which are arguing for the adoption of the Constitution, in Federalist Number 2, Hamilton says, well, you should vote to ratify the Constitution, even though this compromise is terrible. And Hamilton writes, the right of equal suffrage among the states is another exceptionable part of the Confederation. Every idea of proportion and every rule of fair representation conspire to condemn a principle which gives to Rhode Island an equal weight in the scale of power with Massachusetts or Connecticut or New York. And writing at the time of the adoption of the Constitution, Hamilton predicted that eventually the large state populations would rebel against the small states. He says, quote, the larger states would after a while revolt from the idea of receiving the law from the smaller. So that was in 1788-89. The larger states have yet to revolt. But this was controversial even among the authors of the Federalist Papers, who argued the Constitution was good, but the equal representation of the states was a mistake.
Well, we appreciate that call. We're going to go next to Audrey in Eau Claire. Hi, Audrey.
Hello. I was just thinking that this system was created before the Internet, and I do online banking. I think we should start phasing out Congress and give everyone a vote, one vote for what they want to happen, instead of having all these lobbyists involved, and let the Congress become functional society in some other way.
Okay, Audrey's got some really big ideas, getting rid of Congress, going to, you know, a single vote system for everybody. Is that an extension of this idea, Michael?
Well, no, this idea works within the existing constitutional system, and the subdivision of the states does not require any amendment of the basic constitutional structure. It's just multiplying the units. You know, your caller is quite within her rights to think about 21st and 22nd century alternatives to this very territorially based system of representative democracy that we have and that other democracies have today, though.
You mentioned, a bit of a disagreement between the founding fathers of our Constitution and those who have written the Federalist Papers. And I'm wondering, though, if the current setup of the government does address your concerns. You had mentioned the malapportioned Senate, having two senators from every single state, not being a fair representation of the larger states versus the smaller. But isn't that what the House of Representatives is for?
Well, not according to Hamilton in the Federalist Papers. That is, even the Senate should more or less reflect population. The difference was the scale of the constituencies. So the idea was not that the Senate should represent you know, essentially acres instead of people. What the basic idea was that the House of Representatives would have very, very small districts that are very close to the people. And by the way, in 1789, in the first Congress, the districts were much smaller than they are today. And then the statewide districts in America, which then had a much smaller population, would be somewhat bigger. So the idea was, and in the bigger districts, it was thought that having more of a variety of interests would tend to moderate things. So that particular special interests could be reflected in the House. But the Senate would tend to be more moderate because they had a larger, more diverse constituency, as did the president. And that would continue to exist even if you had so much smaller states.
I want to look at another aspect of this, Michael. You also say that splitting up big populous states would let governments and regions, states essentially, form around people who have things in common. And you give Austin, Texas as an example. It could be.
Well, I'm a native of Austin.
There you go. It could be, what did you call it, Centex? Central Texas, the state there. But America's not really founded on the idea of letting birds of a feather flock together. It's, you know, a melting pot, or it's at least a tossed salad. Wouldn't this idea just sort of increase local tribalism?
Well, it might, but on the other hand, if you look at what goes on in state governments now, you have essentially most states, and I'm sure Wisconsin is like this, you have one or two large metro areas. The very big states like Texas and California have three or four. Then you have small towns and rural areas. And the constant battle, and it's a battle of values as well as of interests, is between the rural areas and the big cities. And so it's not clear to me, having been in state politics in my youth, that the result from the rural people nullifying the urbanites and the urbanites thwarting what the rural people want, that compromise is necessarily better than what you would get if you had somewhat more homogeneous system.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Don in Sparta. Hi, Don.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I basically agree with your guest. I think it's a good idea, but the idea that each state having two senators is unfair, it's the best attempt to compromise a situation whereby if all representation was by population, the small states would never get their interests carried out. They would always be outvoted and outweighed. I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Don.
Well, that's the basic issue. Do states, as states, actually have interests distinct from their people? Or is the conservative evangelical Protestant who happens to live in a liberal state like California, does that person really have more in common with the conservative evangelical Protestant in Wyoming? So it's not clear to me that there actually is anything which a state, you know, one of these kind of arbitrary geographical units, that these correspond to actual populations. And if you look at most states, they're very deeply divided along fairly similar demographic lines. As I said, there's the urban versus suburban and rural divide. There are racial divides, as we've seen tragically, you know, in the last week or so. And it's not clear that a sense of common state identity, even in my native state of Texas, where there's a strong sense of Texan identity, actually corresponds to a real human community.
Well, there's the matter of identity and culture and community, but then there's also resources, financial resources. What happens then to these smaller states or those that are comprised mostly of rural residents and populations? Where does their funding come from for things like schools and roads?
Well, that's why I propose federal revenue sharing. And also going all the way back to the Progressive Era and the New Deal, the compromise that we have struck between the needs for financing, particularly rural Midwestern and Southern states, and the free market, is to have net federal institutions that are regionally organized. So, you know, there are the 12 Federal Reserve Banks. There are there's the Farm Credit System, which is based on regional multi-state credit institutions. So that is a challenge But we actually have 70 or 80, 90 years of dealing with it. And it was decided in the 20th century that there is a kind of nice medium for credit purposes of local business credit and farm credit and housing credit. And the medium is not to have 50 separate public banks and investment institutions, and not one single one in Washington or New York, but to have regional ones. And there are also many, many, many examples of regional interstate compacts where states which share a common river or a common border or a common harbor collaborate in order to have environmental standards or to maintain commercial infrastructure.
And, Michael, we have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Lind is a columnist at Salon and a policy director at the New America Foundation.